This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. 30 years ago, I was teetering on the brink. Either I'd get a fellowship that would yield a reporting job in Moscow, or I'd be stuck in a job that was making me miserable. I just couldn't bear not knowing what the future held. So I threw the coins of the ancient Chinese book of wisdom and divination, the I Ching. And the result was foreseeably Orphic and abstruse. Still, I decided the portents were good, and I felt better. And I'm not embarrassed. We all do it. And weirdly, it may feel even better, surprisingly soothing, if the magic eight ball says, reply hazy, try again, which seems to be the lesson of Iowa. But still, we strain for prophecy.
I was here a little after midnight, and we got a massive change here in Iowa. You can see what it looks like. You just put it up there. 0.2% now separating Bernie. Here's this number underneath the 26.2, underneath the 26. If you can read that, a 550 for Buttigieg and a 546 for Bernie.
The gang at the 538 Politics podcast, an offshoot of the website of statistical analysis founded by Nate Silver, also brought data to bear, but the answer was still reply hazy, try again.
Nobody is doing well. Meaning literally, the chance that no one wins a majority is up to 26%.
From
17% beforehand. So
the storyline going into Iowa was, hey, this is a wide open race and something of a mess. The storyline coming out of Iowa is like, this is really f-ing wide open and a huge f-ing mess.
Zen philosopher Alan Watts once observed that muddy water is best cleared by leaving it alone. But such patience is too much to expect during election times. Though the Iowa caucus is increasingly regarded as unrepresentative, undemocratic, and generally unworthy of the media attention it generates, news producers would probably not be pleased if it went away, because they'd be forced to reinvent their quadrennial election calendars and abandon the easy palaver.
This is turning into something of a cliffhanger here. History tells us that New Hampshire often echoes the results out of Iowa.
New Hampshire loves to be contrarian and turn and do just the opposite of what Iowa does.
New Hampshire has a terrible record of predicting presidents, right? Only about 50-50 at predicting the eventual Democratic nominee. I'm going to throw out some names: Sanders, Clinton, Kerry, Gore, Tsongas, Dukakis, Hart.
In January, a Monmouth University poll found that, quote, from a list of four options, a clear majority of Democratic Party voters, 58%, said they'd rather have a single national primary where every state would hold its contest on the same day. Imagine what riches of policy reporting would rush in to fill that gap, right? But before we get there, we can learn from the past by reviewing how did we get here.
538 has produced a pretty comprehensive three-part series to answer that question. In this clip from the first episode, host Galen Druk explains that from the 1830s right up to 1968, the American system for selecting the major party candidates didn't change much.
The party establishment held the power. Back then, the parties generally used caucuses, which were meetings of party insiders who would select delegates to eventually go to the national convention.
Some of the more egregious examples in the 50s and 60s were the Democratic Party had held some caucuses on trains, and they weren't announced until after the train had left the depot.
That's Wayne Steger, political science professor at DePaul University. Even after party reformers succeeded in implementing primaries in about a dozen states in the early 1900s, they didn't directly influence who the nominees would be.
Most of the time in primaries, you had what were called favorite sons. So, say, a governor or a popular senator from the state, they would run in the primary, even though they didn't intend to run for president.
Once one of those favorite sons won a state's delegates, he could use that power to wheel and deal on the convention floor. The other use for the primaries was for candidates to show party leaders they were electable.
So the most famous story, of course, is Jack Kennedy in 1960 had to run in several primaries in order to prove to the party leadership that his Catholicism would not be a problem in the general election.
Do you want a man for president who's seasoned through and through, but not so doggone seasoned that he won't try something new?
And he had to actually run in a couple primaries to prove that. Hey!
Then came 1968, where all hell broke loose.
In 1968, the Democratic Party is deeply divided, largely over the war in Vietnam, also over the civil rights movement. And during this time, it becomes clear that there is not a lot of support for renominating the incumbent, LBJ. So anti-war candidates step forward, for example, Robert Kennedy and also Eugene McCarthy. Now, a lot of the reforms that took place as a result of 1968 stem from the state convention in the small state of Connecticut. And what happens there is a bunch of anti-war activists argue that the number of delegates who go to the national convention in support of Senator Eugene McCarthy should be proportional to the amount of support there is for Eugene McCarthy in the state of Connecticut. But that's not necessarily the way that things are done back then. The party insiders at the state convention are really the deciders in terms of who the delegates will be at the national convention. And so these anti-war activists walk out and hold a counter-convention separately. They nominate their own candidates to the Democratic Convention in 1968, and they also push to change the rules of the Democratic Party and get other Democrats from around the country on board to ensure that the delegates to the national convention are proportionally representative of how much support candidates have in each state. So fast forward to the Democratic National Convention in Chicago in 1968.
The convention of the Democratic Party nominating tonight its candidate for the presidency.
Anti-war activists bring their proposed rules to the Rules Committee and eventually to the convention floor. What they're proposing is, of course, that the delegates to the National Convention be representative of the voters' preferences, that the voting process, either caucuses or primaries at the state level, have to be an open and fair process, that delegates have to be more representative of the state's public when it comes to race, gender, creed, etc. And so these are significant reforms.
21.5 votes for Senator McCarthy.
Now, the anti-war activists lost when it came to trying to nominate Eugene McCarthy.
And Vice President Hubert Humphrey is the nominee of the Democratic Party for the presidency of the United States.
After he lost, the Democratic Party got together and set out to have state parties in every state in the country change how they do the primary process. And by 1972, there's basically a new primary process in place.
What about the Republicans? Were they having a reform movement at the same time?
The Democratic Party ended up changing state laws, and once the state laws changed, that affected the Republican Party as well. But we didn't see that until the 80s, because Republicans were running incumbents all throughout the 70s, Nixon and then Ford.
This new system, new standards, new laws, yielded a very new dynamic that propelled not a cabal of fat cats, but an entire breadbasket state into a sort of replacement kingmaker. Tell me about the Iowa caucuses.
So after Democrats lose the 1968 election, they put together a reform commission that implements all of these new rules. And one of those rules changes how the parties have to schedule their contests, be they primaries or caucuses. And Iowa ends up moving up its contest to very early in the year. At the time, it's not clear that there are significant consequences or significant privileges that go along with being an early state in the process. However,
his name was Jimmy Carter, when he was running for president.
Jimmy Carter, who is largely unknown in 1976, realizes that if he gives a lot of attention to Iowa voters, because it goes first, if he does well there, the media will pay a lot of attention to him, giving him a boost in fundraising, in the polls, giving him momentum going into the subsequent states. Once Jimmy Carter accomplishes that in 1968, he does well in the Iowa caucuses, goes on to win New Hampshire, and rides that momentum all the way to the Democratic nomination. Then the party realizes what a privileged role Iowa has, and the subsequent candidates vying for the nomination of both parties, this includes Reagan in 1980, start competing very heavily in Iowa and New Hampshire.
How and when did the central parties reassert themselves into the process?
So after McGovern is nominated and then loses in 1972, and after Carter wins but then has a difficult time governing and faces a tough primary challenge from Ted Kennedy in 1980, the Democratic Party realizes it has given up a lot of control and it wants it back. So it makes some rules changes. Most notably, it implements what are commonly known as superdelegates. They used to have the opportunity to vote on the first ballot, so they could really weigh in on who the nominee would be. Now, those rules changed after the 2016 primary, and now superdelegates can only weigh in if there is a second ballot. So if on the first ballot somebody wins the nomination, superdelegates are totally irrelevant. They only get to weigh in if there's a contested convention.
What has the internet done for the party nomination process?
From the 80s, when the Democratic Party creates superdelegates, up until the 2000s, the party does re-exert a lot of control over the process. If it likes a candidate, it can help that candidate win, you know, the Iowa caucus or the New Hampshire primary by giving them endorsements, giving them money, making sure that they're out in front of the cameras, etc. And this is called the party decides theory, which was kind of the reigning theory in academic circles of how the primary process worked for a couple decades. Howard Dean shows that there are serious cracks in that theory and that the party has to be unified and able to exert its power en masse. Otherwise, insurgents can take control over the process. And in fact, Howard Dean gets a lot of attention by running against the Democratic Party.
The most interesting thing that I've found about Democrats is that they're almost as angry at the Democratic Party as they are at the Republican Party.
He was calling Democrats cockroaches and saying the Democratic Party has basically forgotten about us. And he was able to get a lot of attention, raise a lot of money online, and, you know, increase in the polls as a result. A lot of those cracks that start forming in 2004 become visible as the decade progresses into the 20-teens.
What does the election of Trump as the Republican Party's nominee in 2016 tell us about, let's say, another unintended consequence of the primary process?
One of the complexities of our system is that when you have a lot of people running and voters going to the polls in this odd succession, you don't necessarily land on a nominee who is the consensus pick. Any election that has more than two people running in it could result in the winner being positively unwanted by the majority. And so you have, in 2016, a situation where Donald Trump has no party support. He doesn't have the majority of party voters' support, yet because he's able to perform well based on his very enthusiastic 33-some percent of the Republican Party, is winning states and eventually goes on to win the nomination. Now that you don't have people wheeling and dealing on the convention floor, you don't have a place in the process for the party's many interests to come together to try to form a compromise, try to come to a consensus.
Which brings us back to the unintended consequences of the supposed democratization of the primary process back in 68. It has created opportunities for populist demagogues. It has disenfranchised voters. It has vastly increased the influence of big money. And it has turned the media coverage into a year-long season of The Bachelor. How the hell do we fix that?
Well, the important thing to keep in mind here is that if the parties do want to change the system, if they think it would be better to implement ranked choice voting or have one national primary day or reinvigorate the convention process, they could, because this system is not in our Constitution. Parties themselves are not in our Constitution. So the process for finding a nominee is really up to the parties themselves. And in this era where everybody's talking about big structural change and democratic reform, things like abolishing the Electoral College or term limits for Supreme Court justices, this is actually one structural change that would be pretty easy to implement because the parties themselves can do it.
All right. Galen, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Check out Galen's full Primaries Project series at 538.com.
Coming up, on to New Hampshire.
So it's on to New Hampshire.
Follow the yellow brick road.
And let's head to New Hampshire. Thank you, Iowa.
By all indications, we are going on to New Hampshire victorious.
This is On the Media.